Ecclesiastes chapter 5, beginning in verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and it goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to this one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it's known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? This is God's word. When I was a child growing up in Oklahoma, every year the Lions Club of Norman would put on this carnival. And I had a distant cousin who was a member of the Lions Club, and he'd always come give our family lots of tickets. So every year I would go to this carnival. And it was one of those roving carnivals that'll set up shop in an empty parking lot somewhere. You know the type. They're not real big. But there was one ride that I used to enjoy riding. And I'm not sure the name of it, some name like the Zipper or something. But it was one of those rides that, you know, tends to try, at least, to make you lose your equilibrium, to make you feel dizzy, to make you, you know, sick, if it were. The ones where you get into a cage, and the cage is on this horizontal axis so it can, you know, spin around like this. And then, of course, that's at the end of an arm that's going to go around like this. So the idea is that when you get in with your buddies, you know, you rock it and you try to get it to spin over if you can, and then when it starts going, you're just spinning like this all the way around. And every year I would look forward to this ride. I would ride this ride, and it was lots of fun. And then one year I was waiting in line to ride, and I watched as this person had got off. They were green in the face, and they had just lost their cookies all over the cage. And the carnival operator took a big bucket of something, water, and I presumed maybe some bleach, I hoped. And he just tossed it in there over, kind of rinsing it off. And then he just let it empty for a cycle or two, and then he started loading people back in. And I never rode the ride again. And that Carl will write it, it's kind of like life. You know, life is fun. We go through it. But the more that you peer into the details, you begin to see the ugly underbelly of it all. And you start out idealistic and optimistic in your 20s, maybe your teens now, and you grow out of it quicker than others. But if you ask this 20-year-old who just graduates from college, you know, he's going into the world with all these idealistic principles by which he wants to live. And if you ask that same guy 20 years later where his idealism is, he says, it's been flushed down the toilet. I'm a cynic. I'm pessimistic about life. My idealism is gone. And that is the tendency of life. And the Koheleth here, the teacher, the observer, the one who is making these philosophical inquiries, if you will, in this book, is looking at the underbelly of life. It's kind of what he's doing. He wants to explore life and push it and examine it and find out if there is any meaning. This is what we've been looking at throughout our journey in this book. And so he's pushing it, and he's pressing it. And as we see, there's a variety of observations. We could categorize it. We're going to look at in these observations. There's three specific areas that he looks at in his observations to try to find and discover what do we see. And all he exposes is that in all of these areas, there is an ugly underbelly that would lead and contribute to being very cynical about life, especially the structures that we would tend to want to see that hold our life together. So we want to see where this teacher is leading us through these observations. We're going to follow this passage because it gives us some observations and then it gives us some resulting questions. If this is what we observe, here are the questions that we're left with. Now, like a good Socratic method teacher, he doesn't give us the answers. And we're going to look for answers as we finish out this particular look at this text, but for the most part, he gives us observations, and he gives us the questions that rise as a result of it. But there's always this implication that you're going to be given these questions not just so that you can simply move on, but so that you yourself can look to find out where can we find answers. So we're going to do that. We're going to look at the observations, we're going to look at the questions, and then we're going to look at some of the places that we can go to for answers. The implied place, I think, that the Koheleth is telling us where we ought to look for the answers. So, the observed world, the questions, and the answers. First of all, the observed world. There's this set of snapshots of life that he gives us. You could say he gives us a snapshot of three structures in which we try to build or construct or conduct our life. One would be the government. The second would be, you could say, wealth or capitalism, perhaps, if you want to think of it like that. And the third one would be living according to principle, the principled life. These are kind of the different ways, different structures that we would look to stabilize life in a civilized world. If you want to think of it like the modern-day person, the socialist view, the capitalist view, and the idealist view, kind of in perspective and observations here. So he begins to go on and explore, first of all, what is this first structure? It's the government. He looks at the government. He says, do not be surprised when you see injustice going on. So look with me at verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. That's his first thing. Now, we get that. Especially the longer you go in life, the more cynical you become, perhaps of the government in which we're under. But it's not just our government. I know when you're under in a particular government, you tend to think it's your government. But when you look broader across the world, there isn't a government on this planet throughout this history that hasn't had some measure of oppression and injustice going on that we can observe. So do not be amazed at the matter. He goes on to say, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. Now, there's a couple things to observe about this. Because you can look at this in both a positive and negative light. In the positive light, you could say, we observe that there's injustice, therefore, it's good that there is a higher authority over the authorities that's causing the injustice. And then there's a higher authority over him. In other words, there's a form of checks and balances. There is an appeal system. If one judge gets it wrong, you can appeal to a higher authority over him. That's the first picture. We get that people are broken. We get that there's going to be injustice, and we've accounted for it in the government itself by putting authority over authority over authority. Now, if you translate verse 9, that last verse, which translators will tell you, they really don't know what that verse means. If you have a little footnote in your Bible, it's going to probably say that. But ESV translates in a kind of a positive sense, but this is gain for a land in every way. A king committed to cultivated fields. This appeal to the broader king, the highest of authorities. He's committed to this, and therefore he's put these higher authorities to make sure that there's an appeal system for justice. We get that. Checks and balances. We like that. But the negative side of that is there's lots of bureaucracy as a result. Who's going to pay the bills of this higher authority and this higher authority and this higher authority? Well, you are. Built into the system that's meant to protect you is also oppressing you. My kids discovered this with their very first paycheck when they looked at it. And they thought, where's my money? I thought I was giving this much an hour, and I'm only getting this. Well, you see, the federal government is taking their share. You know, the local government is taking their share. The school system is taking its share. The mud district is taking its share. Everybody's got. And that's the negative way that NIV, if you have an NIV, translates verse 9, which says, the increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. There's a sense in which everyone is exploiting you to some degree. And this is what the Kohelth is observing. And interestingly enough, he's observing this as the one who has declared himself to be the king over a nation that is under, purportedly, a just God. So even in a kingdom with a king who's been anointed by a just God, we find this broken system exists. And you've got to think that that's a little bit disheartening. And I think that's exactly where the Kohelth is going. This is a grievous evil under the sun, this brokenness. The second thing, a vain pursuit. The second structure in which we look to kind of build a sense of life and security around is our wealth. And so he spends time talking about our wealth. We've already looked at this a little bit earlier when we were looking at the beginning chapters in Ecclesiastes, but he's simply reminding us once again that the problem with wealth is, or the love of money, is that the more you get, the more your craving for it increases, and the less the money that you get satisfies that craving. It's like any addiction. The more you get, the more you want, and the less satisfied you are. Think about that. The more you get, the more you want, and the less satisfied you are. That's exactly how he's describing the love of money. Now, and this is really the second pillar of foundation upon which modern society wants to build its security, is our wealth and our money. And he exposes this on a couple of different fronts. One, he exposes it in the fact that he's seen a grievous evil take place. Someone who has acquired wealth, well, in one bad venture, it all goes awry, and he loses it all. There's a sense in which you can't count on money because you never know when that bad venture is going to come. You never know when something is going to happen and all of your wealth is going to see itself out the window. I'm sure there are many of you have experienced that to some degree or other at some point in your life. And it's very discouraging. It's very disheartening. It's one of those things that drives you towards a pessimistic view of life. But then there's the other flip side of the case he talks about here. The guy who doesn't lose his bad venture but enjoys it all and has everything that he wants. And he eats and eats. And it describes him as one who can't sleep because his stomach is not empty but full. So even if you get all that you want, your stomach is full and it keeps you up. Now, in a literal sense, have you ever done this? You ever eat too much and you go to bed and you can't sleep? The other week I was visiting Oklahoma and I'd been eating. I've been trying to eat healthy, so I've been eating all these vegetables. I've been eating all this broccoli. Have you ever eaten too much broccoli? I'd be waking up in the middle of the night and I feel like my stomach's going to explode. You know, it's just, I don't know what's going on. But it's keeping me up all night. You know, he's saying that's what wealth can do, not if you lose it, but if you gain it. It has this effect on you. It's not giving you what you think it's going to give you. The second structure, in other words, is broken. The government's broken. The structure that it seeks to provide, the wealth and the structure that it seeks to provide is also broken. The third one he points out is a little bit different. He's talking about kind of a principled life, if you want to think about that, a compass by which we want to live by. Remember, he's holding back no punches as he looks at this book. And in the end of chapter 5, beginning of verse 18, he seems to turn a corner and talk about something that's positive. If our government is broken and if our wealth is broken, well, how can we possibly find some measure of enjoyment? And so he has this summary. This is a summary that we find more than one time in this book. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. So there's the sense, and we've talked about this already, here's an application of wisdom. In light of the fact that our structures are broken, that wealth can't help you, don't look to the government to be the thing that's going to finally bring you out of your oppression. Just recognize that your particular lot in life is a gift of God and find the joy that can be found in the midst of it. There's a sense of practical wisdom. Just be content with what you have rather than longing for more. Now, that's practical wisdom, and that's good. We like that. But I wanted to include chapter 6 because chapter 6 seems to all of a sudden turn that very thing on its head. He says this, "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he." There's a sense in which he's saying, look, sometimes all that you build your hope on disappears and is gone. Sometimes it doesn't disappear and you get all that you want, but you find your soul never finds satisfaction in the things that you have. Sometimes that gift of contentment that God can give isn't given. And this is what the Koheleth is observing. Remember, wisdom are principles to live by. Ecclesiastes is the book that says, you know what? They're just principles. They don't always work. And that's what he's having to wrestle with. Can I find a sense of meaning as I take observations about life? Now, you can do that to some degree, and you can write a book on Proverbs. This is what I've observed about life that's generally true. If you live this way, you'll generally be okay. And many people can live according to these principles most of their life and be fine. But there's always those exceptions that you find are living according to the principles, and life isn't fine. And that's what the Koheleth is observing here. He's pointing it out. Look, I can't find an underlying system that's going to answer all the things that I observe in this life. That's what he's pointing out. Not that everyone's going to be miserably unhappy, but the fact that some people are. And if some people are, it means the system as a whole cannot be figured out. There are times when things just don't follow the normal rules. It's even principled living, in other words, can be broken. So these are his observations to be the cynic. All the structures that I would seek to construct or conduct my life in accord with, government, wealth, principles, can at times break and leave me hanging, leave me in the dark, leave me in a place where I could say it's better off to not have been or to have been stillborn than born. Number two, the questions that rise as a result. We find this at the end of chapter 6. Look at the beginning of verse 7, chapter 6. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. This is interesting. He's giving you a measure of practicality, but then he also says it's vanity. Better is the sight of the eyes and the wandering of the appetite. That's a general principle that's true. I can say that. And yet at the same time, he can say, but it's also vanity. If I'm going to hang my hat on that as always being true. It's generally true, therefore it's wise to live according to that. But I can't hang my hat on that, because in the end it's vanity, it's striving after the wind. Verse 10, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? We go back to this guiding principle, as he's pointed out time and time again, the wise and the fool, while it's better to be wise than foolish, in the end, the wise and the fool both die. And they both end up in the same place. No one can see beyond their own grave. No one can see beyond what we observe in the real world. That's what he's saying. He's saying, under the sun, all we are left, when we press and press and press to look for patterns and structures that we can build a life around, in the end, leave us only with questions. That's what he's saying. It leaves us with questions. Can we find ultimate meaning as we look in observations under the sun? He's saying, no, we're just left with the questions. We can guess. We can speculate, but that's the best we can do. That's where he leaves us. That's where he is. That's where the questions take us. It is a perspective that many people in the modern world have wrestled with. You know, you might not think of this, but one of the great philosophers of our day is Woody Allen. Now you're thinking, Woody Allen? Yes, Woody Allen. Woody Allen, if you've ever watched a Woody Allen film, he likes to make films that wrestle with this very perplexing idea that I simply can't find meaning in life. And how do I live in light of that reality? He with his latest film, he was being interviewed about this very thought, and this is what he had to say. He said, I firmly believe, and I don't say this as a criticism, that life is meaningless. I'm not alone in thinking this. There have been many great minds, far, far superior to mine, that have come to that conclusion. And unless somebody can come up with some proof or some example where it's not, I think it is. I think it's a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. So that's just the way I feel about it. I'm not saying that one should opt to kill oneself, Alan said, but the truth of the matter is, when you think of it, every 100 years, there's a big flush, and everybody in the world is gone. And then there's a new group of people, and that gets flushed. And there's a new group of people. And this goes on and on interminably. And I don't want to upset you. I find it interesting to keep saying that. Toward no particular end, no rhyme or reason. That's why over the years I've never written or made movies about political themes. Because while they do have current critical importance in the large scheme of things, only the big questions matter. And the answer to those big questions are very, very depressing. What I would recommend, this is the solution that I've come up with, is distraction. That's all you can do. You get up, you can be distracted by your love life, by the baseball game, by the movies, by the nonsense. Can I get my kid into this private school? Will this girl go out with me Saturday night? Can I think of an ending for the third act of my play? Am I going to get the promotion in my office? All this stuff, but in the end, the universe burns out, so I think it's completely meaningless. I have thought to myself at times that there's a story in two filmmakers. One filmmaker makes films that are deep, intellectually profound, and confrontational, and the other one makes purely vacuous, escapist films. And I'm not sure if the one who makes the escapist films is not making a bigger contribution than the one who makes the deeper films. You know, he's living in the reality that, yes, under the sun, in terms of what I can observe, I can't find the answers. I can't find a common thread that's going to allow me to build a life on accountable, dependable structures. In the end, there is no meaning. All I can do, the best I can do, is distract myself from that depressing reality. Now, many of you may be thinking, oh, I'm not in Woody Allen's shoes. I believe in God. I believe beyond this. I'm not sure that I'm with you. But what I find is interesting is the book of Ecclesiastes is written by one who's purportedly a believer in God. And we acknowledge he's a believer in God. We just looked in the previous chapter, his big application for us was fear God. So it's not as though he himself is an atheist. But the interesting thing is he lives in some ways as though he's an atheist. He's living in the sense that, look, I don't see or I don't recognize any evidence that there is something outside of our system acting. He's living that way. He's choosing to live that way. He says, if I want to build my life upon only that which I can observe under the sun, this is where I am. And I think a lot of people who would call themselves Christians are doing the exact same thing. And it's not surprising because we are a society that has grown up under the influence of what happened in the 19th century, what we often refer to, or the 18th century, we often refer to as the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment said our greatest source of knowledge, our greatest source of wisdom and knowledge is not what God has revealed to us, but what man has able to rationally come up with based on what we can observe in the world in which we live. If we limit the authority of truth to what we can observe and reason out, this is the influence of the society in which we've grown. So even though we may say that we believe in God, we live with this great influence of the Enlightenment upon us, and we don't really credit God as existing in and about our system. So we, too, struggle with these same questions. Maybe God exists, maybe he doesn't, but I need to build a life practically. How can I look for systems that are going to do it? And I can't find any that are going to give me consistent answers. Life is meaningless. Now, I think the Qoheleth is not meaning to leave us where Woody Allen leaves us. All we can do is look for good distractions. I think he does want us to look for answers. I think he's asking those questions not so that we would be left thinking that all there are questions, but I think he's asking those questions so that we will ourselves will look for the answers. So when he says, who can tell man what will be after him under the sun, I don't think he's saying there is no answer. I think what he's saying is there is no answer to be found if we are limiting our observations to under the sun. I think that's so vitally important. So I want to turn to point number three and the needed answers. So the observations, the questions, and the needed answers. And I want to start by talking about the story of C.S. Lewis a little bit. Because the Qoheleth doesn't give us any answers, by the way. It's not his job. Remember, he's the guy who leads us to the edge of the cliff and invites us to peer over the edge to see where under the sun is going to lead us so that we will do our own thinking about where do we find the answers. And I want to talk about C.S. Lewis because C.S. Lewis is an interesting story. If you know the story of C.S. Lewis, he grew up in a broken home, not the traditionally broken home, but his mother died when he was just about when he was 10 years old. He didn't have a good relationship with his dad. His dad sent him off to boarding school. He was an angry person with regard to all that had gone on, especially toward God for taking his mother, the only one who provided him some measure of security in this life. And he rejected God outright. He proclaimed himself an atheist even as a teenager, and one of a tutor that he had that prepared him to going before he went to school at Oxford was an atheist as well, and really trained him how to think rationally as an atheist. So this is how Lewis began his journey. And Lewis is one of the deepest thinkers, I would say, of the 20th century. So if you read his stuff, sometimes you have to stop and you have to reread it, you know, one, two, three times to identify what is he saying, because he's thinking so deeply and he's turning his thoughts about over and over and over, looking at them at all of the angles, and he's thinking about this whole idea, can I live as though there is a God? What if God does exist? Does he exist? And if he exists, what matter does it make? You know, that was his view. Because in his view, he'd say, if God is this God of the Bible exists, then he is a God who created all that exists. Therefore, he is a God who stands outside of his creation. He must. He's like an author of a book, he says. It would be like Shakespeare and Hamlet. Can Shakespeare and Hamlet know each other? Well, no, because one lives in this system, the real world, and one lives in this book, and the world that book is about. They're totally different worlds. They don't interact. There's no interaction between the two. That was his idea, that even if God exists, so what? He exists outside of creation, and there's no way for Hamlet, for example, to know Shakespeare. And so therefore, how do we go on living? Well, let's imagine Hamlet for a minute. Hamlet can certainly imagine that maybe there's a God over him. Maybe there's a writer who created me or an author or whatever it is to my life. But it even doesn't matter if he speculates that. There's no way that Hamlet himself can ever meet him, because he doesn't exist in that world. And as Lewis was contemplating this early in life, and he begins to come back to that later in life, he's thinking about that, and the reality hit him. There is no way for man to ever know his author unless the author chooses to write himself into the story. Because while Hamlet can't write himself into Shakespeare's world, Shakespeare could write himself into the world of Hamlet and have the characters interact. That's a possibility. Some of you may have read, there was a book that did that. I think it was the book Inkheart. I think my daughter turned me on to reading that book, where the author writes himself into the story. It's an interesting plot line, if you haven't read that book. But as Lewis goes on and think, if I could ever know God, it's only going to be because God has chosen to write himself into my story or into my world. And as he considers the reading the Gospels and reading the New Testament, realizing that's exactly what the Incarnation was God writing himself into the story of man, of God taking on flesh, just like Shakespeare taking on the flesh and going and meeting Hamlet face to face. God was taking on flesh and coming to meet man in his world, on his terms, in his place. And what's interesting about that is this a God that we can trust? Is this a God that we can look to? And you think, well, this is a God who willingly subjected himself to all of these broken structures that we ourselves are having to live in the midst of. I mean, think about when Jesus was incarnate in the flesh, what was the structure? What was the government structure that existed? It was a corrupt structure. It was a structure that failed him in every regard. If the Romans were supposed to make sure justice happened, Pilate rejected justice, what should have happened, by kicking back Jesus' cake, by taking Jesus' case on when it wasn't in his jurisdiction to do so. You remember what he tried to do? This is a matter of your own faith. You guys deal with this. This has nothing to do with me. But they insisted, and so he took up the case. And Jesus died as a result. What about wealth and money? Well, Jesus never had any of that. He was a man who says, I don't have a place to lay my head. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head. So wealth never supported him. What about living principled life? Did Jesus live a principled life? I would say he lived the most principled life that anyone ever lived. And they killed him for it. So every one of those structures that the Qoheleth observes, ultimately, in the end, can fail us, did, in fact, fail the author who wrote himself into our world. And the whole reason he did that is so that we could know him. Now, here's what's interesting. In John's Gospel, he introduces Jesus, not with Jesus' name. He introduces him with a very interesting Greek word. He says, in the beginning was the Logos, as he calls him. Now, the Logos was a loaded term in the Greek world. We've talked about this before, if you've been around here. The Logos means reason or meaning. You could say the Logos was the thing the Greek philosophers were all looking for. They were looking for some ideal that would make sense of the world that otherwise doesn't make sense. The very thing that Qoheleth observed. What is that one thing that will finally make sense of all these observations that I've made? If I can just find the Logos as a philosopher, then I can make sense of this world in which I live. Not only for me, but for all those around. And so John introduces Jesus in that way. He says, in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now they could get that. Yeah, we get that. This ideal is ultimately kind of like our God. If we can find it, or him, if you want to call it a him, it'll make sense of things. And then in verse 14, John says, or verse 12, John says, and this Word became flesh. This ideal that will make sense out of life is not an ideal after all. It's actually a person. He's the meaning. In other words, the meaning isn't to find an ideal that makes sense of life. The meaning of life is to find a person that will give you meaning in life. And that's how John is introducing Jesus. Someone that is the rationale, the reason, the ideal, the thing that makes sense of our living, who has chosen to enter our world to face the broken structures that we ourselves live in, so that in the midst of that we can cling to Him and know meaning, even if we don't have answers. And that's so important to understand, because the Bible isn't a book that just gives you all the answers. It's a book that points to one who has the answers and says, this is enough. It has to be enough. Because in the end, if our lives are finite on this earth, under the sun, there is not enough time to get all our questions answered. There's just too many, and they're too deep. So the comforting fact is, here is the one who does have all the answers, and our invitation is to know Him and to trust Him. This is where Ecclesiastes takes us, ultimately pointing to, is there meaning in life, leaving us there at the edge of the cliff, wondering if it's true, leading us to look in a place that's not under the sun for those answers. And of course, it's the rest of the scriptures that fill in the holes. That says, yes, there is one who exists that's not under the sun, but who came to this world to live under the sun so that we might know Him. And through that, have meaning, even in the midst of our questions being unanswered. That's our hope. So whereas the structures, the broken government leaves us with a sense of brokenness, wealth leaves us with a sense of emptiness, principled living and failing leaves us with a sense of hopelessness. Jesus comes to heal the brokenness, to fill the emptiness, and to stop the hopelessness by pointing what exists after this. There is life after this. How do we know? Because the grave didn't stop Jesus. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we are grateful that You wrote Yourself into our story, that You came in the flesh, in time and space and history, live under the brokenness and the emptiness and the hopelessness that defines our world, in order to break through and to show us that there is hope, that there is meaning, that there is life beyond this life under the sun. Lord, I pray that You would reassure us of Your love for us, as we consider what Jesus endured while He was here in the flesh, as He went to the cross, as He died under the broken systems to prove to us that there is life beyond this death, to prove to us how much He loves us and cares for us and desires to have a relationship with us by writing Him into this broken story so that we could learn to trust Him, to trust the one who does have the answers. Would You help us to do that in Jesus' name?